Chris O'Connor here. Join our fabulous curmudgeonly community on Facebook at facebook.com/group/curmudgeonrock. Also look out for a Spotify playlist dedicated to this episode. Now, let's get started.
This is the Curmudgeon Rock Report, and this is your podcast, made by rock geek iconoclastic outsiders for rock geek iconoclastic outsiders. For those of you who lament that rock music has gone the way of jazz and slipped into niche genre status, we are here to keep that flame alive by providing insight, analysis, recommendations, and honest takes, not hot takes. And hey, there's a good chance you'll learn some rock history you never knew before. So, Rod Stewart. To younger generations of music fans, he's kind of a joke. He's that classic rocker that baby boomers love, and to this day, you can hear a regular rotation of five or six of his songs on classic rock radio. And to be honest, Stewart hasn't done himself any favors when it comes to unloading that joke tag. Since the mid-1970s, while he scored many worldwide pop hits, the vast majority of them haven't necessarily aged well as enduring timeless classics, except for those five or six you hear on classic rock radio. That's because the vast majority of those hits range from extraordinarily cheesy, of-their-time fluff songs to dreary, cringy ballads. Between that, his god-awful Christmas albums, and his multiple residencies in Las Vegas hotel casinos, one can be forgiven for not giving a shit about Rod Stewart. But if you put your historian cap on and dig deep into his discography, especially his very early period from 1969 to 74, you'll find some shockingly great albums. Yes, most of his songs were covers, but they were exquisitely soulful covers that weaved American music forms such as blues, R&B, gospel, folk, and country into a rich tapestry of singular rock and roll. What set Rod Stewart apart from other British contemporaries who delved into American roots music, such as the Rolling Stones, was his unique ability to make acoustic music rock as hard as any kind of music made with electric instruments. Throw in that passionate, gritty, sandpaper voice of his, and the recipe was there for a rich and rewarding discography. Then, well, he just wanted to have hit songs, date fashion models, and be a superstar. On one level, you can't really blame him. I'm sure he has no regrets when it comes to his cock in his bank account. But man, oh man, did the music suffer. On this episode, we're going to analyze what exactly happened to Rod Stewart, why and how he sold out so quickly and so badly, and ultimately what his legacy really is. Yes, folks, it's Let's Take Down a Baby Boomer Icon time here at the Curmudgeon Rock Report as we ask the eternal question, Rod Stewart, what the fuck happened?
The engines are churning. The phasers are turned to 11. Everything is cranking, and it's everything is now thrusting towards a place that we all know and love, and we visit every episode, the parallel universe. You love the parallel universe too, don't you, Arturo?
Yes, and even Rod Stewart has a place in the parallel universe.
Yes, a very remote place in the parallel universe, but he does. Yes, the parallel universe, this is the other side of the space-time continuum where rock and roll is still predominant and is still on the billboards and in the arenas and on the cover of Rolling Stone. And, you know, we all still light those lighters at the arenas to like great rock and roll songs, great rock and roll ballads, and we celebrate the music. It is not a niche. It is very, very much celebrated. This is a long way of saying that this is the segment where Arturo and I cover new and newish albums by artists we think that you should dig and that you should check out, and the artists that are kind of keeping the flame lit for rock and roll eternally here in the world and also in this parallel universe. So Arturo, who on this episode are you covering here in the parallel universe?
Yes, I'm covering Sarah Halgan and her album Hedo Dower.
I don't speak the language. I can't really say it correctly. But anyway, Sarah Haugen hails from Somaliland, not Somalia, but Somalia's neighboring country, a country that fought very hard for their independence. As of this podcast recording, they are not a generally recognized country, but hell, I really like the music coming out of this country. So the Curmudgeon Rock Report recognizes you, citizens of Somaliland. In case you don't know, Somaliland is in way out eastern Africa on the Gulf of Aden, bordering Djibouti to the northwest, Ethiopia to the south and west, and Somalia to the east. Haugen is a singer, songwriter, guitarist who, backed by her super tight band, take the trancey, hypnotic desert blues of groups such as Tenari Wen and Imar Khan, and filter it through a slightly psychedelic, slightly off-kilter, super groovy garage rock filter. This is primo African rock and a delight for anyone who's with musical tastes lending themselves to such esoterica. Opening track, Sharaf, kicks things off in high octane. The offbeat time signature of Somaliland, Ani Adi, drives a track that burns with subtle intensity. Lialau starts with a mid-tempo tribal rhythm groove before launching into full-blown krautrock with Haugen's chiming hypnotic guitar leading the way. Let me read this carefully. Divuhidi is just raw, dirty East African funk. It is a terrific album that proves you sometimes have to go to the cradle of human civilization to find the best music being done in this or any era. Chris?
Yeah, you know, the thing I like about this record is its straightforwardness. And it's not, like you mentioned, Tenari Wen, and then, you know, you've got them, which is more Western Africa, you know, Tenari Wen, and then you've got your Mamdou Mokhtars and folks like that, where it's more sort of a hypnotic effect of what they're doing, and it's more sort of layered and those types of things. Here, it's just hard driving, and it's really kind of in your face. I think you had it right. It's Somaliland garage rock.
Yeah.
And kind of figures that it would border Djibouti, because this album, Shake Djibouti.
Yeah, it's funky.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. It's funky, and it's got, you know, really kind of gnarly guitars in spots where you wouldn't expect them, and right. just really great rhythms. And she's an interesting story because, you know, she's roughly our age, from what I understand, and there's a little bit of a late bloomer as far as her music. She escaped. She moved back. From what I read, she moved back to Somalia about a decade ago after being in Europe for the better part of about 30 years, you know, which kind of escaped the when it was more sort of tumultuous, but she's moved back. And so this is sort of true to her roots, at the source of her roots. And so, really compelling listen, and a really good call bringing her in to the parallel universe. It's her kind of stuff. And that's gotta be about the we've probably done a dozen African records in the lifespan of the parallel universe. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. Three places that really great music seems to be coming out in droves: Los Angeles, Australia, Africa.
Two continents and a city.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, pretty much. And that's it. But it's interesting that the African contingent is so strong and has been for the duration, and here the entire 2020s, really. A lot of good stuff coming out of there. So looking forward to that. And then we switch from there to something that is much more close to home, especially for me. I am in a house here just outside of Houston, Texas. And Houston, Texas is where Kruangbin is from. Kruangbin, that's the Thai word for airplane, by the way. They are a trio of Houston natives who specialize in a kind of lounge funk. But that's kind of giving it short shrift. I mean, this is really a band that you should be excited about, even if their latest album isn't their most exciting effort to date. I would say they're one of the more original and thrilling of revivalist bands in all of rock and roll, because what they do is that they, if it has anything to do with groove, if it's in the area of groove, they're kind of an encyclopedic practitioner and explorer of groove, whether that comes in the form of dub reggae or Middle Eastern folk or West African jazz or Latin rhythms or just straight disco or 70s sort of bedroom funk. It's all there. They explore these various contours of groove, and they do it all with a very reverb heavy guitar style. And so it's very engaging, and it's one of those things where there's enough quirky influences, and it's all in the mix, that it all comes across as pretty original. I would say at their best, Kruangbin is a 3S kind of band: sexy, sensual, and scintillating. And so I will vouch for them.
And with this new record, same sounding.
Yeah, pretty much. And that's kind of so we're kind of coming to them. I'm excited about this band, but not about this new record. The new record is called A La Sala. It's just out as of the beginning of April. And I guess what you could say about the album is that it's light on songs and heavy on guitar jamminess.
Yeah.
And the songs often feel too short and actually half-baked. Most of the songs are 2 to 3 minutes. And while the guitar sound is engaging, the guitarist in this band, Mark Spear, is actually very, very good, as is their bassist, Laura Leochoa. I mean, they're kind of the creative forces of the band. And then they have their drummer, DJ Johnson. So they're a trio. His guitar playing is pretty adventurous, and so there is some interesting sounding stuff on here. Two highlights to mention: A Love International, which is a pure disco flare-up, and then Pon Pon, which has an extremely Afrobeatish kind of vibe, extremely Afrobeatish kind of vibe. And so there's those two, but other than that, there's just like a lot of ideas, more than fully realized songs. Which is a step down from 2020. And what makes it so disappointing is back in 2020, they released an album called Mordecai, which
Great
is,
record.
10 songs, 43 minutes, really tight, really focused, and just really engaging. And it goes all over the place. It's the best song on it is called Pelota, which is
Pelota, ball, yeah.
as in ball in Spanish. But it's just this really, it's this Latin groover. It's just kind of has a lot of flavor to it. And then the single, probably the song they're most well known for, is called Time, You and I, which is a 70s loving bedroom funk, if there ever was one. It's just really sensual and like, music to get your, to get your groove on too, for sure. And just a lot of flair. And again, the West African stuff is really, really strong on Mordecai. I would say that the dubbiness, especially the second half of the record, it's very heavy on dub sounding guitar and bass. And after a while, they do kind of build to a hypnosis. If you listen to the record, it's the kind of record that you want to listen to, on a drive, or just put on headphones and just kind of sit back and just relax and listen to it, because there's a depth to it that is very, very surprising and very, very nice. So what I would say is Kruangbin, they're a band to be excited about. Check out Mordecai and study that and make that a starting place. Give A La Sala its props, at least for continuing the sound. And for Spear, doing some nice cranking in a few spots. But yeah, it's way too half-baked. They had 4 years. They could have done something better than this, you know?
Yeah, and this isn't a band I normally really like. In fact, if I recall, I'm the one who turned you on to this band 6 years ago with their 2018 album Con Todo el Mundo.
Yep.
That being said, I'm really disappointed with this new record. It's an unrelentingly one-note record whose
Yep.
biggest sin is that it just recycles everything they've ever done before and everything they're typically known for into one monotonous, same-sounding bore of an album.
Yeah.
With Con Todo el Mundo, they experimented with Middle Eastern tones and sounds in their guitars and embellished their sound with funk rhythms.
Yep.
With their splendid 2020 album, Mordecai, they experimented with Latin rhythms and pop melodies. There's no expansion of their sound here. There's no variety. There are no variations in tempo and rhythm.
And there's no melodies.
And yeah, there are no melodies. And if there are, they're way too subtle for the listener to even give a shit to notice.
Yeah.
There's one track in the second half that breaks the tedious nature of this album. It's a funky little number with a disco beat and rhythm called Hold Me Up.
Yeah.
But other than that, this is music for narcoleptics.
Chris here again. Arturo and I have differing feelings about the subscription streaming service Spotify. While he likes to rail against the algorithmic component, I like the ability to find and then manage a personal catalog of music. The program is especially great for assembling playlists. Well, guess what? We've assembled a playlist to accompany this episode. The playlist features a healthy mix of all the music we describe and analyze during the episode. Think of it as a soundtrack to your curmudgeonly life. Find the link in this episode's description. And also become a member of our curmudgeonly community on Facebook if you haven't done so already. Let's now return to our regularly scheduled programming.
So why are we dedicating an episode to Rod Stewart? And why are we calling it Rod Stewart? What the fuck happened? Well, this really comes back to February, this past February, 2 months ago. And a couple of news headlines or a couple of things stood out to me. First, Stewart, in what has become part of a big trend in the music world over the last several years, was able to successfully sell his publishing rights and his publishing catalog and recorded music, as well as some of his name and likeness rights to Irving Azoff's company, Iconic Artists, and he sold them for $100 million. Rod Stewart, yes, is a $100 million artist, according to the valuation of what pretty much amounts to the private equity world or the private equity wing of the music business right now. So I thought that was astonishing, especially since a week later, he released his latest piece of schlock, an album called Swing Fever, which, as the title suggests, is an album of old-timey swing covers that he did with band leader Jules Holland. And I also saw that he's doing yet another residency in Las Vegas, which is something he's been doing off and on for like 20-something years now. So Stewart kind of sold out, and here he was cashing in, but it was in the context of selling out. And it was too bad, because the beginning of Rod Stewart's career, the first 6 or 7 years of Rod, were really quite great, weren't they, Arturo?
That's what we're going to talk about first. Before we get into Bad Rod, we got to talk about Good Rod. There was a time when Rod Stewart was actually really good. Basically, here are the beginnings of him. He first got really noticed when, from early 1967 through mid-1969, he was the lead singer of the Jeff Beck Group. The Jeff Beck Group was a band formed by, obviously, the legendary guitarist Jeff Beck, shortly after he quit the Yardbirds. The Jeff Beck Group basically traded in heavy blues rock, the kind of which Led Zeppelin would take to another level, and with more originality and musical diversity in just a short time after Beck formed his group. Stewart received critical acclaim for his deeply soulful, gravelly sandpaper voice, his passionate delivery, and compelling vocal phrasing, as well as being an incredibly charismatic performer and frontman. It was only a matter of time before he went solo, and that he did, signing with Mercury Records in the US and Vertigo Records in the UK and Europe. Stewart was smart about it, though. He knew being the lead singer in a moderately, modestly successful band like the Jeff Beck Group wasn't enough to catapult him to a major solo career that quickly. So he parlayed his solo record deal into taking the Jeff Beck Group's bassist, Ron Wood, and having the two of them join another band called The Faces. First, Yes, I mean that Ron Wood, the guy who in just 6 years' time would become the lead guitarist of the Rolling Stones. Second, the Faces were originally the Small Faces, a hugely successful rock and soul group that lasted from 1965 to 69. Lead singer and guitarist Steve Marriott left the group to form Humble Pie, while the remaining members, drummer Kenny Jones, keyboardist Ian McClagan, and bassist Ronnie Lane, chose to stick together, drop the small from their name, and recruit Stewart and Wood, thereby completely remaking the band into The Faces. They were known as a terrific live band, and while they had a couple of pretty good records, particularly 1971's A Nod Is As Good As a Wink, their loosey-goosey, boozy, ramshackle, gut-bucket rock and roll was mostly a facsimile of the Rolling Stones, but
Yep.
without the songwriting genius of Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. Stewart would eventually formally leave the band in 1973 after his solo career had exceeded the Faces' profile in terms of popularity. And it's easy to see why. It's with Rod Stewart's early run of five solo albums from 1969 to 74 that one gets to truly hear the depth and breadth of Stewart's musical vision and artistry in its purest form, uncontaminated by commercial pressures, expectations, and even temptations. He would always manage to put three or four original songs in each of his albums, and some of them are superb and wonderful. But for
Absolutely.
the most part, Stewart knew that he nor none of his bandmates were songwriters on the caliber of contemporaries such as Lennon McCartney, Jagger Richards, Bob Dylan, Ray Davies, or Pete Townshend. Give him credit for that humility that persuaded him to instead interpret other people's songs and imbue them with his own unique twist that at its core was a hybrid of folk, soul, and gospel. Yet when Stewart chose to unleash his rock and roll soul, it was a fascinating and thoroughly unprecedented amalgam of revved up, turbocharged folk rock, where you really heard an where you rarely heard an electric guitar at all.
Yeah.
Stewart had a gift for making acoustic music rock as hard as
Absolutely.
any made with a full electric band. And that, along with his distinctive voice, is what he should always be remembered for. I think so. Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. Like some of the stuff, I mean, like Every Picture Tells a Story, deserves to be on any list of the top 200 records ever
Yeah.
made. And be it's because of what precisely what you just said. It's mostly an acoustic record that
Yeah.
just rocks and
Yeah.
just it just has this swagger to it. And you know, between his voice being as gravelly and as deep and as soulful as it is, juxtaposed with some really just strong songs. And I said Stewart, you know, he wasn't a prolific songwriter, but at his best, he could
He
write a
wrote some
really
great songs. Yeah.
he could write a really strong tune. I mean, Maggie May, Mandolin Wind,
Yeah.
you know, just some of that other stuff. You Wear It Well. Yeah.
Yeah.
And just, you know, the fact that he could write songs, you know, that good. But at the same
Yeah.
time, and as you said, throughout, and even Gasoline Alley, the title
Yeah.
track to the second song,
Sure.
you know, is a really strong folk. It's basically a folk ditty, but it's very,
Yeah.
very strong. And
Yeah.
so yeah, he had that talent. And this was back when he's kind of in when he had some sort of musical vision,
Right.
and you could call it that. The guy had a musical vision of,
Right.
and I think you put it beautifully, which is ramped up soul rock
Yeah.
or folk rock. I
Yeah.
mean, ramped up folk rock with a little bit of soul. And it even like some of the choices that he made of covers on his albums, like covering Sam Cooke's Twistin' the Night Away,
Yeah.
it's just perfect for Rod
Yeah.
Stewart.
Yeah.
Or like covering Hendrix's Angel on the same record,
Yeah.
N Never a Dull Moment, which Never a Dull Moment's not actually that much worse than Every Picture Tells a Story.
Yeah, it's his second best album.
It doesn't count as an all-time great, but there's some really great stuff on there. But yeah, him covering Hendrix is quite a revelation,
Yeah.
for sure. And then also another great song in his canon is Reason to Believe, which he did in every.
Tim
Yeah, Tim
Hardin's.
Hardin's
Yeah.
song at Every Picture Tells a Story. Although, tell you the truth, my favorite version of that is on the Live Unplugged record from 1993. That's
Yeah.
really, really strong, soulful version of that. So, Yeah, Rod had the chops, and he had the musical vocabulary, and he did have some sense of vision. And this was before he got too successful for his own good, which I'll talk about later on in the episode. I think that that success be kind of became dominant ahead of musical. Whatever he had as musical vision, kind of fell victim to the success.
Right. And speaking of that musical vision, let's break down his first five albums, as we call this section, When Rod Was Good.
Yep.
The first album is called his debut solo album, An Old Raincoat Won't Ever Let You Down, from 1969. I've always been of the opinion that people should just not be allowed to do Beatles covers.
Right.
Why? Because they usually, as in 95% of the time, fucking
Suck.
suck. If you're going to cover a Beatles song, make it so completely different from the original so that it's unrecognizable. And if you're going to go that far, just go ahead and write an original song. I think the same can be said for the Rolling Stones. I've rarely, if ever, have heard a good Stones cover until I heard the opening track of Rod Stewart's debut album, where he covers Street Fighting Man. Right off the bat, Stewart shows his early genius for hard rocking acoustic music, taking the Jagger Richards original way down into the swamp for a soulful blues revamp. He even twists the melody around to make it catchier and more appealing. Midway through, the song breaks down and reassembles into the track we're all familiar with, but there's a clarity and an intensity to it that, in my opinion, blows away the original. Yes, this is the only Stones cover that I think is better than the original. Sorry, Stones
Wow.
fans, it's true. He also does a lovely version of English folk legend Ewan McCall's Dirty Old Town, as well as a stirring, transcendent version of Mike D'Abbo's Handbags and Glad Rags. Stewart's originals are pretty damn good too, with both Blind Prayer and the title track full of bluesy, menacing, Stonesy swagger. It's a deep, rich, soulful, terrific debut album. Play this record for anyone who only knows Rod Stewart from his cheesy hits from the late 1970s onward, and they wouldn't know this was the same guy. Chris?
Yeah, this pretty much counts as a folk record, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because it's got an inherent acousticness to it, but also just the quality of the singing. It's down and dirty. It
Yeah.
it, it it's a down and dirty acoustic record. I really like the title track. Always have. And you're right about that version of Street Fighting Man. That too, it really grabs you in the cajones.
Yeah.
The way that Rod does it. So off to a really engaging start, and it didn't really, it was still miles away from what he was doing 2 or 3 years later, but it kind of showed that he had bona fides.
Yeah.
This was a
Yeah.
calling card. If anybody was thinking, oh, he's just the singer for Jeff Beck, no,
Yeah.
he had a lot more to say and a lot more ways to say it. And
Yeah.
he wasn't just Jeff Beck's lapdog.
Yeah. And he did more of that with the next album, Gasoline Alley, from 1970. Now, Cut Across Shorty is one of 1950s rocker Eddie Cochran's most famous songs. It's a jaunty, country-ish kind of a rockabilly track. Well, in Rod Stewart's hands, the acoustic guitars and violin are the only thing remotely country about his version, which he injects with something I call gleeful venom. It rocks with a raw, live in the studio, visceral energy that blows the original away. And nope, not a single electric guitar in sight. The Rolling Stones had a big hit in 1964 with Bobby Womack's It's All Over Now, but Rod Stewart one-ups them again. I can't believe I just said that.
Yeah.
With an anthemic, down and dirty, boogie-woogie piano-based version that just turbo jams for 6.5 minutes. He takes the small faces of My Way of Giving and gives it the gospel fervor that the original aspires to. And he even has the faces, the original small faces, backing him on the track. And yes, the originals are, again, pretty damn good, with the title track and Joe's Lament being delightful slices of country soul. It's a terrific follow-up that's every bit as good as his debut. Chris?
Yeah, It's All Over Now is as good as advertised. I do think it is better than the Stones version.
Yeah.
And Rod kind of makes it his own. I mean, he
Yeah.
makes it into a Rod Stewart song, which,
Yeah.
obviously was one of his great talents, was
Yeah.
he could take anything along these lines and turn it into a Rod Stewart song. I like Country Comfort as well.
Yeah.
That's a cool little song.
Yeah.
And so just and then Gasoline Alley, the title track, is it's just very, very nice folk song. So yeah, here again, I think he ups the turbos a little bit on this record
Yeah.
from where it was. And again, consistently, these albums, he raises the tempo, he raises the volume, and the swagger gets swaggerier
Yeah.
as we go along. And so this is the beginning of that kind of challenging himself with more and more swagger.
Right. Speaking of swagger, the next one, 1971's Every Picture Tells a Story. This is the album that became Stewart's commercial breakthrough and the one that made him an international star, mainly off the monstrous success of the single Maggie May, a Stewart original that was a worldwide chart topper. If you don't think you've heard it, no, you have.
Yes, you
It's a
have.
ubiquitous, timeless classic. And yes, it's an all-acoustic rocker, something that no one did better than Peak Rod. The album itself is a stunningly perfect album, easily one of the 500 greatest albums of all time, one that even Rod Stewart haters have to acknowledge. The title track is an epic travelogue of a traveling rock and roll bad boy that makes one wish they were along for the ride.
Yep.
His version of The Temptations' I Know I'm Losing You rocks with primitive yet tasteful power. And yes, it is better than the original. Sorry, Motown fans. Stewart's gorgeous version of folk singer Tim Hardin's Reason to Believe is the definitive version of the song. And he even does justice to Bob Dylan with an exquisite countrified version of Tomorrow Is Such a Long Time. It's an album that should be a part of any music aficionado's collection. Chris?
I agree with every word you just said. I have to give it up for the title track. One of my personal favorite rock songs of all time.
Yeah.
The outro to that is just pure, just rocking genius.
Yeah.
And with him and the backup singer, and just sort of them going off each other. And there's
Yeah.
just it just really just elation
Yeah.
that they reach on that. Strange but true, he co-wrote that song with Ron Wood.
Yeah.
And so, the two of them make for good partners. And I'll tell you, there's something about Every Picture Tells a Story. As phony, it's you can, of non-Stones, Stonesy-ish records, this may be the
Yeah.
best
Yeah. Yeah.
of all time. Of kind of like non-Stones going for sort of Stonesy vein. This might it's probably an insult to call it a phony Stones record.
Yeah, it is.
Because it actually it's more it's as close to that Stewart ever got to making an actual Stones worthy record.
Right.
And so it kind of
Totally.
sits stands right alongside, and with some of those Stones records, I think it's almost as good as a couple of the records. Like, it's almost as good as Sticky Fingers. It's almost as good
Right.
as Beggar's Banquet.
Yeah.
And I think it stands the test of time, for sure. But yeah, that title track, Magnifique.
Yeah. His follow-up to that one was another big hit record, Never a Dull Moment from 1972. Country music was always an underrated element in Rod Stewart's early sound, and never was it more evident than on You Wear It Well, the lead single from this album, another Stewart original and another massive worldwide hit. True Blue is another Stewart original and opens the album with vintage heavy blues rock stomp. There's another Dylan cover with the blissful, gorgeously melodic Mama, You've Been on My Mind. The album ends with two covers by classic R&B soul giants. The first, a steamy version of Etta James's I'd Rather Go Blind, and the second, a kick-ass romping version of Sam Cooke's Twistin' the Night Away. This is easily Rod Stewart's second best album. Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said before, the highlight for me is the cover of Twisting the Night Away.
Yeah.
And only because it's kind of freaky how he kind of channels Sam Cooke's energy on that, because Cooke had a little bit of he Cooke's voice is butter with a little bit of gravel,
Yeah.
whereas Stewart's voice is gravel with a little bit of butter. And for some reason, he captures the kind of the essence, and it's very, very reminiscent of Sam Cooke's vocals on "Twisting the Night Away," and it's just so kind of a neat trick that he's able to kind of step into that pocket and really pay tribute to Sam Cooke so well
Yeah.
on that song.
Yeah. And then the next, the last of Rod Stewart's halcyon years, Smiler from 1974. Now, when this album came out, it got panned by critics. But listening to it now with contemporary ears, that critical reaction is pretty perplexing. Maybe it's because of the terminally cheesy, totally misguided cover of Carole King's You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, retitled You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Man. Aside from that, though, this is a blisteringly good album, quite possibly Stewart's most rocked out rocking album, and the one that features the most electric guitars. You get a rocking version of Chuck Berry's Sweet Little Rock and Roller, a thoroughly rocking Stewart original called Sailor, an energetically rocking version of Elton John's Let Me Be Your Car, with Elton himself guesting on the song, a testicle-pumping version of George Young's Hard Road, George Young, by the way, being the late older brother of AC/DC's Malcolm and Angus Young. This album just fucking rocks. Even the album's mellower moments are worthwhile and feel epic, with Stewart tipping his hat again to one of his heroes, Sam Cooke, with a lovely medley of a Bring It On Home to Me, segueing into Send Me. Stewart even flexes his muscles with his increasingly apparent gift for interpreting Bob Dylan with a stirring, moving version of Girl from the North Country. This is the last truly great Rod Stewart album before the commercial rot started to set in. Chris?
Yeah, I come away from this album really wishing that he had done an album of nothing but Chuck Berry covers.
Yeah.
Because how fabulous would that have been?
Yeah.
That would have just been, that would have been unbelievable, because that's my favorite track on this album is Sweet Little Rock and Roller.
Yeah.
It's just awesome.
Great version of Sweet Little Rock.
I know. And it's just like Rod just, you know, plays that role really, really well. And again, he brings in a band that, you know, like lives up to the guitar fury of Berry, that lives up to, you know, just the volume, just bang, bang, boom, boom, bang, bang, boom. Yeah. And so there's that. And then I also like the Elton John song on it too.
Yeah.
That's just fun. You know, Rod does Elton, you know,
with Elton, Elton, with Elton. Track.
Yeah. With Elton. But the fact that Rod could do Elton, almost as well as Elton could do Elton at that time.
Yeah.
Says something for his range as a rock and roller. So, you know, so like again, so in a way, you get these three albums in a row. Every Picture Tells a Story, Never a Dull Moment, and Smiler, and you get to peak Rod. We're at this point, we are now at peak Rod, and so you know, peak Rod was as good as anybody that's ever lived.
Yeah,
in a lot of ways, like I said he deserves his props. Just fabulous, fabulous rock and roll singer and star, but also just a guy who just embodies the spirit of folk, of blues, of rock and roll.
On this episode, we broke down the polarizing career of Rod Stewart. For the next episode, we're jumping back into our ongoing hip-hop series as the timeline takes us to the period of 1986 to 1991, otherwise known as hip-hop's golden age. Why is that? Well, this is the era where hip-hop came of age as an album-oriented art form, with some of the finest records, not just of the genre itself, but of all time being released and helping change the landscape of popular music. Run DMC, Eric B. and Rakim, Public Enemy, N.W.A., De La Soul, The Beastie Boys, Gangstar, and A Tribe Called Quest all released timeless masterpieces that will be discussed in the next episode of the Curmudgeon Rock Report, Hip Hop's Golden Age, 1986 through 91. All right, so we just went over Rod Stewart's best albums, which is five of them, his first five, when Rod was good. And then starting in 1975, he probably bought a little too much into his own hype, and his music took a steady downturn. I mean, he still kept having hits, but they just weren't as good anymore. Chris, what the fuck happened to Rod Stewart?
Yeah, I think you pretty much said it, that, you know, Rod Stewart at that point had become popular enough and famous enough that and he was well known as a ladies man and as a party guy. And he's one of these guys that would go drinking, and like him and Rod Wood would throw televisions out of hotel windows and this type of thing. And so he was kind of caught up in his persona. And I think what happened was, is that, you know, it's the kind of persona that craves relevance in order to subsist.
Yeah.
And that's perhaps the trap that Rod Stewart ended up falling into. But he didn't really fall into it immediately. What you did get in 75, and that's really where it starts. He did two pretty good, not great, but pretty good albums in 75 and 76, Atlantic Crossing and A Night on the Town. You know, both of which are kind of divided into a soft half and then a hard half.
And the soft halves are really bad.
Yeah, and the soft halves are are pretty atrocious. And but you get so he, but what ends up happening is he establishes on those records two Rods. There's the slick rocker Rod, and then the sensitive lover boy Rod. You know, one way or another, he was a sexy, sexy blonde haired rock singer man. And and that again, that was the persona. So I think he kind of bought into this notion that he had his own hype. And I think there two things happened to one, like you said, the previous album Smiler kind of bombed, both commercially and with critics, and wasn't as successful. And then also in 75, Rod Stewart moved to America. He emigrated and he settled into Los Angeles. And so I think that given the change of scenery, given the pressures that he had, this is where you get those two Rods that I talked about, and he starts talking with the persona, or he starts messing with the persona. And so then you can then tell the rest of the story by going through a increasingly lousy string of singles. It starts out okay, and then it goes completely downhill, and that's where we're going to start. We're going to go from 75 all the way through 1993. And so, so this turd burger starts with a song called "Sailing," which is the closing track on the album "Atlantic Crossing," and it is an unbearably bad folk ballad that actually went to number one in the UK.
Yeah,
and I think it didn't chart in the US, but it was a number one hit in the UK, which is really what he needed at that time. And I think that kind of sent him the message that ballads were the way to go.
Right.
And, you know, and this is, you know, this is just, you know, pure, you know, lacquering on the, lacquering on the overdubs, lacquering on the strings, you know, the sort of the major key kind of soaring vocals, trying to be epic, but really coming across more as cheesy. And that's kind of where this falls. And so that's really the beginning of it, is the success of Sailing. And then in 76, that becomes probably, I think, his biggest hit overall, which was Tonight's the Night, Gonna Be All Right.
Yeah.
And, which you probably know it. It's supposed to be a romantic song, but it's just this towering shower of shit. And it's just this.
It's very schmaltzy. It's very schmaltzy.
It's very schmaltzy. It's very schmaltzy. Yeah, it's corny. He's trying to play like a lover man. The middle of the song even has like cooing come-ons by some lady.
Yeah.
In the middle of it, that kind of go over the track, like the it's got this really slick lead guitar part on it, and it's Rod emoting more than Rod hath ever emoteth or emoteth since.
And you know what?
What's that?
Janet Jackson's version is way better. Janet Jackson covered this song in 1997, I believe. I think it's on her Velvet Rope album.
Yeah.
And she reinterprets the song in the Rod Stewart original. It's him basically propositioning a woman. Oh yeah, we're going to make sweet love tonight.
Yes.
In Janet Jackson's version, it's her having a threesome with a guy and another woman.
Hey,
and, hey. Well. Like she begins the song by saying, "This is just between me and you," implying that it's a threesome. Yeah. And then she sings "Cause I Love You Boy" in one verse, and "Cause I Love You Girl" in another verse. So It's a much more risque version. It's a better production. It's the better, her version is like a really cool, smooth 90s neo soul kind of version. I like
her version. Yeah, and let's celebrate the artistic license of Janet Jackson, because left in the hands of Rod, I mean, come on, this is just white boy R&B soup. It's terrible. And it's just insufferably dramatic.
Right.
I think is the way you could put it, which is too bad, because that's the first song on the album, A Night on the Town. The second song is a really great cover of Cat Stevens's The First Cut is the Deepest, which I believe he released as a single. It was a minor hit, but he kind of proved that he still had that ability as an interpreter of other people's songs.
Right.
And it was still alive and well. And so it's too bad that Tonight's the Night became this enormous hit. And if anything, that became the trap for Stewart, because now Stewart has the perfect song to go with that perfectly cheesy persona of the lover boy, lead singer, blonde haired, sexy, sexy man. And so now it's like, oh, now I know what I'm striving for the rest of my career.
he strived for it. However, just a couple of years later, he would bounce back with a big hit and a huge rocker called Hot Legs, which I actually like. I like that song.
And I like Hot Legs too. And this comes off the next record. He actually has a record called Footloose and Fancy Free. No joke, that's the name of the album. Rod is so into his shtick at this point that even his album titles are into the shtick. Come on, man. Footloose and Fancy Free.
Listen, man, Hot Legs, I mean, it's the dopiest guitar riff of all time, but I love it.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's so dumb. Yeah, but it works.
Yeah, it's a great dumb song. I'll admit that Hot Legs is not a classic. It would not have any place on any of those other of those first five records. but it's just dopey fun. And
artists who have covered Hot Legs include Tom Jones, Tina Turner. Tina Turner, the rock band Orgy, and Bon Jovi.
Yep. And Hot Legs is most famous, by the way, for a performance that Rod did of it in 1979, I think, on Saturday Night Live with Tina Turner.
Yeah.
And with Tina Turner rocking those legs.
Yeah.
And just it's a really, really sexy performance because of Tina. And so, so Hot Legs comes in there. And again, it's dopey, but at least it's fun, and at least it was banging. But it still kind of showed where Rod was beholden to these two, this sort of dual persona of the crooner lover boy on the one hand and the horn dog on the other.
And then they come together,
both of them, in the unbelievably awful You're In My Heart, The Final Acclaim.
Oh, man. Yeah. God, I hate that song.
Yeah. And so that comes in, and that's the other hit from the 1977 record, Footloose and Fancy Free. That went up to number four on the Billboard Hot 100 charts. Obviously, it wasn't anywhere near as big as Tonight's the Night. Like I said, that spent 8 weeks at number one on the Billboard Hot 100. So that was a huge hit. You're In My Heart, comparatively, is minor, but it is so bad. My respect for you is immense. It's just so bad. So bad. Yeah. And he wrote that one. And he wrote it. And it's meant to be a sing-along. And yeah, you could sing along to it. And maybe it's a little bit catchy. But it's catchy in the way that a harpoon to the chest is catchy as well. It completely keeps going downhill. Again, beholden to the persona, and he's sinking further into it. But that persona did have one positive that came out of all of this, and it was like a detour in the midst of all the schlock. He comes up with something great, doesn't he, Arturo?
Yeah, the album is called Blondes Have More Fun. It's a terrible record, but it has one song that was a titanic, monstrous international hit single. It is probably the best bad song ever written and recorded. And it's Do You Think I'm Sexy?
It's Rod. Do you think I'm sexy?
It's Rod doing disco. And it is such a, it's a fun fucking song. It's cheesy. It's corny. It's every, you know, a lot of rock musicians and artists were doing disco by the late 70s. Kiss had their run with I Was Made for Loving, Loving You, Baby.
Yeah.
And this is Rod Stewart's venture into that, but this is a better song. It's cheesy, it's corny, it's really over the top, but it works because he's winking at you with this song.
Yeah.
Rod Stewart himself knows this song is corny as hell. But you know what? It's such, I hate to use the word guilty pleasure because no one should ever feel guilty but what they like. But this really is the ultimate in guilty pleasure pop songs. It really is something. It's, you got to hear it. You really got to hear it.
Yeah. It's the ultimate parody of disco because
it kind of is.
If you listen to the lyrics, it's basically all about the guy who's, you know, out to like slip a Mickey in some girl's drink and get laid.
Right.
And it's just, that's all he has on his mind. And he's just a walking dick. And, and so in a way it's kind of a parody of the whole disco scene, by him doing that. But you know, it's got its charms though. Like it's got that fun little keyboard riff. It's got, yep. And it's got that fun, it's so decadent. And it's got that fun little bass line to it too. You know, it's just, and just, every, you know, every, everything about it is, you know, everybody involved in it knows that they're making a bad song. Strange but True. It was written, co-written by Carmine Appice of the Vanilla Fudge.
Peachy. Yeah. Yeah. But here's the thing about that song. The chorus melody stolen by the Brazilian singer songwriter, George Ben, from his song, Taj Mahal.
You mean stolen from. Right.
Yeah, stolen from that song. Yeah. And apparently there was a copyright infringement lawsuit. He sued Rod Stewart. And apparently the case was, quote unquote, settled amicably between George Ben and Rod Stewart. And Stewart admitted it in his autobiography in 2012 that it was unconscious plagiarism of that song. When he heard the song at a Rio carnival in 1978, early 1978, he went to carnival in Brazil. He heard George Ben perform, heard him play that song. He's like, oh, that's a good melody. Let me use that.
There
you go. And he got sued for it, but they settled amicably. So George Ben cannot be too unhappy because I'm sure he makes money every time that song is played.
Yeah. Coincidentally, in a woke world like ours is today, I don't think Blondes Have More Fun would get much traction
Think I'm Sexy would.
Yeah, maybe. But then he's got songs called Ain't Love a Bitch, Attractive Female Wanted, and Is That the Thanks I Get? It's cheekily misogynist.
Yeah.
Misogynist nonetheless. But cheekily misogynist, I'm not sure that Rod could get away with making Blondes Have More Fun here in 2024, you know, for sure. And so we kind of talked a little bit lovingly about the beginnings of bad Rod Stewart there, right?
Then it gets really, really bad. Enter the 1980s.
Where, yes.
And to be fair, not just Rod, every one of his generation sucked in the
And I said it before that when you're beholden to a persona such as Rod's, what it craves most is relevance.
Yeah.
And so once you get out of the 70s and you get into the 80s and you have these holdovers from the late 60s, well, what do you do to stay relevant? Like even Bowie fell into this, you know, it's like, Let's Dance. Let's Dance is a good record, but it's Bowie selling out.
Right.
And so you have everybody that's in the midst of selling out. So we talked a little bit lovingly about a couple of these songs, but it's starting in 1980 where it starts to get just bad, where and it starts with an album from 1980 called Foolish Behavior, where he shacks up with a guy named Kevin Savagar, who was I guess he's a classically trained piano, but he's kind of a ballad man. And kind of a almost like a soft rock kind of songwriter who basically writes everything on this record except for one song, which he co-wrote. Right. Savagar co-wrote it with Rod and a couple others called Passion. And it may be the single worst song of all time. It's got a bass line that's kind of sort of reminiscent of the one from Do You Think I'm Sexy? And in some ways, maybe it's supposed to be Do You Think I'm Sexy Part 2, because it's very horn dog in its focus. Obviously, the name is Passion. And it even has the world's most terrible lyric, "Even the president needs passion." Yeah.
I guess he's talking about Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, at this point, he must have been talking about Jimmy Carter needing his passion. But it basically, it's so bad because it has this bent for drama that borders on like Jim Steinman Meatloaf territory.
Yeah. And it was a big hit, though. Number five in the U.S., number 17 U.K.,
yep.
Number two in Canada.
Yeah. Hey, I'm surprised it didn't go number one in Canada, because at the time Canada had Rush and nothing else. You know, it was pretty bad. So there he goes there. And then he goes and he gets a little bit more interesting. I think what happens in 1981 is that Rod decides that in order to stay relevant, you have to go with the musical trends. Right. And obviously in 1981, when you're a Brit, and the rock and roll world, the major trend is new wave.
Yeah.
And so Rod decided to go new wave in 1981 with the album Tonight I'm Yours. And it's very new wave pop by the numbers.
Yeah.
With, you know, it's shuffling rhythms and shiny piano keys and clap drums and just, you know, just sort of
reverb in the drums. Lots of reverb.
Yeah. Reverb in the drums. Big drama, you know, sort of big, you know, sort of over the top, almost, you know, this kind of almost campiness is caught in some of these songs. And he had two hits on the album, Tonight I'm Yours, which, you know, the title song, which is extremely new wave, but boringly new wave too. And so it's kind of like a new wave template, but just really, really boring.
And then he had the song Young Turks, which he really shows him embracing the cheesy 80s production values.
Yes. And doing it well. I have a soft spot for Young Turks, I have to admit.
Young Turks, be free tonight.
It's on your side.
What a lame song. It's so bad.
Yeah, but I do kind of like it in the sense that it is earwormy, and it is my only issue with it is that it's got the keyboards and it's got the reverb and it's got all that, but Rod's voice kind of gets lost in the track. That Rod has this great voice and he's kind of singing in a high register in this song, and he kind of suspends the gravel, but it gets lost in the mix. And so it's just his voice is just another instrument, and so the production really robs it of its power. It like blends in a little way too much with the backing track. And so it doesn't quite serve Rod well. I like the song. Ultimately is a guilty pleasure type of song, but it doesn't serve Rod well in the least. And so here again, craving relevance, he's starting to lose himself. Literally, he's losing himself in the song. And so not a good thing. One other thing to mention about Tonight I'm Yours is that it's got a really, really weird cover of Bob Dylan's Just Like a Woman on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's alarmingly bland.
Yeah.
With Rod just sort of yelling his way through it.
Because it's sad, because in his peak years, he did great Dylan covers.
Oh, he did great Dylan covers. Yeah. I mean, he did, you know, like several of those records. He actually did a really great cover of Girl from North Country at one point too.
Right. I mentioned that earlier. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so for him to do this, and for it to be so thinly produced and so thinly arranged, and it attempts to be bluesy and sexy, but really just comes across as corny. And
something he was becoming an expert at in this point.
Chris here again. We usually end our episodes by inviting you to join our curmudgeonly community page on Facebook. Well, we're picking up our efforts there. Know people just as passionate as us about rock and roll? Invite them to join in the fun. You don't actually need our permission to do so. Also, expect to see a lot more content up there moving forward. Our mission is to engage you, so darn it, we'll engage you like a fire hose, or maybe like a firehouse, if we're going to give love to Gene Simmons. We may also be making a few offers. Want to wear a t-shirt featuring our logo? You may have that opportunity soon. So be a fellow curmudgeon, help us expand our little community, and share your own musings via your own posts. We're at facebook.com/groups/curmudgeonrock.
And then we go fully down into the drain, starting with 1983's album Body Wishes.
Had a big hit with Baby Jane.
Yeah, most of which Rod didn't even write. he did co-write Baby Jane. And big hit. It was his last number one song in the UK, and it got to number 14 in the US. But the song at this point, it's not new wave. It's at this point, it's just plain old 1980s drama-rama bullshit.
It's awful. It's pretty bad.
And it's just it doesn't have, you know, it professes to, it has harmony vocals without a strong melody, which is just a clusterfuck.
And check this out. Number one in the UK. Guess where else it was number one?
Where's that?
Belgium, Ireland, South Africa, Spain, and West Germany.
West Germany, and, not East Germany.
And it was number three in Zimbabwe.
Okay. Well, Zimbabwe was really hurting for Zamrock again at that point, weren't they?
Number nine in the Netherlands, number two in France. This song was a monster hit. Number 10 in Norway, number 14 in New Zealand.
I know it's going to last forever.
Just 10 in Australia. Mm-hmm. Like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. But the album Body Wishes, is just kind of like if you went into a bar in like middle America and there was like some synth rock band like playing covers.
Yeah.
That's what Body Wishes sounds like. It probably sounds like your local synth rock band that was playing down at like Trudy's bar on a Tuesday night.
This period is also the peak of Rod Stewart's hair. His hair was never bigger than during this period.
Yeah. His hair got fluffy. It got feathery. I'm jealous. I have hair envy when it comes to Rod Stewart sometimes. He had that like that tuft in the 70s. It almost looked like a spider in the 70s. It becomes this like almost like a palm tree. It gets to palm tree heights here in the 80s. It's good stuff. And so the train keeps rolling on. And by this point, he's ceased to have an identity of his own. He's just kind of he's making pop hits for pop hits' sake. He's going with the MTV trends. He's beholden to getting to the charts at any and all costs. And so then that's why in 1984, you get Infatuation.
The song from the album Camouflage, just as bad as the previous album.
Yep. And Infatuation is slightly better than Baby Jane, but that ain't saying much.
The video is basically him being a creepy stalker.
Yes.
That's the video.
Yeah. The video is him as a creepy stalker. But he's a sexy singer, blonde-haired singer man, creepy stalker.
Yeah. Infatuation to me is like one of the worst Rod Stewart songs ever.
Yeah.
Oh, no, not again.
Yeah.
So terrible.
Yeah, but at least it's got Jeff Beck on guitar on it. It's but the only, the yeah, only saving
I'm
grace.
Sure Jeff Beck was really proud of that one.
Yeah. I'm sure he was. Yeah. It's just bad. And it's pop by numbers. It's just Rod just singing to sing and just, you know, not even crooning, and it doesn't even have the gravel. I mean, at this point, he's almost shouting instead of singing. And then from the same album, Camouflage, comes the immortal Some Guys Have All the Luck.
He did not write this one.
He did not write this song. it was written by a guy named Jeff Fortgang. But
who the hell is Jeff Fortgang?
Just some nobody. if he was a somebody, he was a somebody back then. He ain't nobody no more.
Hey, Robert Palmer covered it.
I know. I mean, but like I'm saying, it. Yeah, is it a little bit catchy? Sure. Does it have a strong melody on it? Kind of. Sure. But it's a straight, soulless, slick pop song. Just very, what would you call it? Almost like homogeneously pop. It's what you expected from MTV in 1984. It might as well have been the cover song for 1984 in for MTV. But it did make it to number 10 on the Hot 100. Infatuation, by the way, made it to number 6.
I know.
So
What the fuck?
he's still scoring hits at this point. Well, during this streak,
None of which have aged well at all.
no, not at all. In 85, he found his way back to near the top of the pop charts, but this time with Jeff Beck. Jeff Beck from an album that Beck did in 1985. Beck did a cover of "People Get Ready" by
Chris
Mayfield,
Mayfield.
and it shows that even with songs you think you can't go wrong with, you can go wrong.
You can go wrong. Hey, man, they torture this song.
Yeah, they really do. It's this thin, thinly processed, like badly produced, echoing song with with a very uninspired vocal by Stewart. And just like Beck doing just like just you know just no just corny, just general straightforward Beck. And just like just here's some blues licks to People Get Ready. And it's just it's the outright torture of an all-time great song. It's too bad. But at least that was better than Love Touch.
Oh, man.
Love Touch. Let's just put it this way. The best use of calypso drums in rock history is probably Jane Says by Jane's Addictions. The worst use of calypso drums in rock and roll is on Love Touch.
Written by Michael Chapman.
Yes.
Wow.
And the use of calypso drums is even worse than Kokomo. That's how bad it is. It
Yeah,
just
it's pretty bad.
has a dopey, dopey vibe to it. And it basically it's almost like they were it's like the music you would expect from a cereal commercial. It's like they were selling Wheaties.
Well, you know what it was used for?
What's
It
that?
was used in the end credits to the Robert Redford, Deborah Winger movie, Legal Eagles.
Legal Eagles, yeah. Yep. And it again became a top 10 hit in the States. And it was on the album 1986's Every Beat of My Heart. Which might as well have been called Every Beat of My Ass. Yeah, it's just pretty bad. So, speaking of which, the title song on Every Beat of My Heart was a big hit in the UK, not here. It's a slow burning romance type of thing, echoey as hell, but it's boring. The one thing that you can say about most of these songs is that they were bad, but they weren't boring. Every Beat of My Heart is just boring. And so now we're building up to it kind of reaches the pits, the absolute pits. You can't really call it the peak. Peak Rod is 1974. Pits Rod is 1988. And he has a couple of songs that he did that year that merit a quick discussion. Forever Young, which is not the Dylan cover. It's not a Dylan cover. It's an original co-written by Rod, which it just kind of basically showed that he was solidly adult contemporary for life at this point. I mean,
Well, apparently Bob Dylan is credited here. The song it's Rod Stewart, Jim Cregan, Kevin Savigar, and Bob Dylan.
And like I said, he interpolates the kind of the may you also, that.
It's not the complete Dylan cover, but he takes certain words from the Dylan original and puts it in.
And he kind of takes the "May you do this" format of Dylan's "Forever Young," so it's not a straight cover, but it's tortuous. It's tortuous. And again, here by this point, he's still beholden to his desire to become relevant, and he's still trying to be slick rocker and smooth Rod all at once. And it really is just kind of a confused, muddled mess at this point. By this point, he's just a plug and play adult contemporary artist. He's kind of sucked the soul out of what he's doing. But at least Forever Young, you at least remember it in your head. The other big hit from that record, which went to number 4 somehow on the Hot 100, was My Heart Can't Tell Me No, which, yeah, exactly. It is the most generic piece of shit possible. It's a pure slick pop song. Is written by two nobodies named Simon Climie and Dennis Morgan, and it's the kind of song that is so bland and is like so nondescript. You could have inserted Michael Bolton in there. You could have inserted Kenny Loggins in there. You could have inserted Peebo Bryson in there. And it would have sounded the exact fucking same.
Yeah.
That you wouldn't have noticed that, you know, Rod has no identity in this song. The song is just pure hit making with no soul or differentiation whatsoever. And it tells you how bad the song is that I listened to it five times today. And right now I can't hear it in my head.
Yeah. Well, you know, the following year, 1989, Rod would make Tom Waits a lot of money.
Yes, he would. And actually, this is, you know, we've been bagging on Rod here for a while. I think at some point, I look at My Heart Can't Tell Me No as the nadir for Rod, because he had a little bit of something of a comeback from this point on.
Right.
That he didn't go back to being great Rod by any stretch, but he started to regain some respectability.
Right.
And that starts with Downtown Train. Again, this is a Tom Waits cover. You know, the original is on the amazing album Rain Dogs from 1985. And Rod does a good job with the song.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's not bad. You know, I still much prefer the Tom Waits original.
Oh, of course. I do too.
It's more poetic. It's more soulful. It has more nuance to it.
Yeah, and in Rod's hand, it's sort of like an anthemic pop song. It's done as anthem pop, and it is arranged as anthem pop, and it's designed to show off Rod's big voice. So at least Rod has now come back from the dregs to at least start showing off that raspiness in his voice again, and the gravel. And so so the gravel is there, the power is there, and that sort of, you know, the gleeful pop singing is there. And so that kind of comes back. And so then out of nowhere, Rod was sort of good again. And that really starts, you know, once you get past Downtown Train in 1991, you have the album Vagabond Heart, which actually has three very strong singles on it. And so this, I guess you could call this a little bit of a comeback for Rod. Again, it's about respectability, not greatness. But but the three singles on this album are all very good. Rhythm of My Heart, which is sort of Celtic, sort of Broadway, sort of soul. Probably his best song since Young Turks, and maybe since back to, like, you know, You're in My Heart, or Tonight's the Night, or even before that.
Rhythm of My Heart went to number 7 in Zimbabwe.
Nice. And it went to number 5 here. Yeah. And again, it has this kind of almost Celtic-y folk vibe to it. So there's that. Then he has the Motown song, which he's back with The Temptations, which I always like that song. That's really, really catchy, really soulful, really true to Motown type of song.
Number one in Zimbabwe.
Yeah, doesn't surprise me. And number 10 here in the States.
Number 1 in Canada.
Yep. And I said, and that's probably my favorite. Motown song is probably my favorite late period Rod Stewart song. You know, again, it just has this nice little rumble of a chorus, and just it's rousing. Right. And the temps being on it, you know, gives it a nice density, a nice depth, a nice vocal depth to it.
Right.
So, and then the highlight is a duet with Tina Turner called "It Takes Two." Which is a pure soul nugget. It didn't chart in the U.S., but it went to number 5 in the U.K. And there, Tina's the star.
It's a song made famous by Marvin Gaye, right? It takes two, baby. That's what it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's a single. Yeah, it's a cover of that song. But it's Tina Turner kind of really starring on her vocals. And so at that point, Tina, from like 84 to like 92, Tina's vocals were awesome.
Yeah,
like just routinely awesome. And so any song that features an awesome Tina Turner vocal is okay by me, you know. And again, he's almost embracing black music on this album a little bit. So he goes beyond folk and he goes into soul. And that spills over, because also on this album, it didn't become a hit until 2 years later, but there's a cover of Van Morrison's Have I Told You Lately on this album as well. A live version of it from the album Unplugged and Seated, which was the soundtrack of a MTV special that he did. That came out in 93. And at that time, the live version of Have I Told You Lately became went to number 5 on the Hot 100. Yeah. And so it's interesting to hear Rod Stewart do Van Morrison. Yeah. And to do, in some ways, arguably almost do Van Morrison better than Van Morrison.
Hmm.
In some respects.
Yeah. I've never been a fan of that song, to be honest with you. I just thought the lyrics are too trite, a little too sentimental. You know?
Yeah, but it's good. But,
there's a difference between emotional and sentimental.
Yeah,
you know?
But it's a good wedding song.
Yeah, I guess.
Come on. It's a good wedding song. And Rod sings it with real sincerity. And so I guess that's the end of this. And it's really where I guess we end this whole thing on a lament. That he kind of rediscovered something resembling credibility or respectability here at the end. Makes you wonder why the hell he lost it in the first place. It was like starting with Blondes Have More Fun.
Yeah.
Even with the fluke success of Do You Think I'm Sexy, the rest of that album, and then everything he did from 1980 all the way through 1989. Or 88 was just, you know, indescribably offensive.
It's really bad.
Yeah. I mean, but it's not just bad. It's offensive because Rod sold out. And, you know, I saw that he did an interview with GQ back in 2013 where he says, hey, I'm not going to apologize for that. I kind of like my money. I like playing with my money because, you remember, he had a soccer pitch on his on his property. On all his properties. He was a big soccer head. So the guy had his own soccer pitch on his property. And so, hey, you know, more power to him. But what did you do to get that kind of money? What did you do to get that $70 million that you were worth? That's just not, it's not cool, Rod. But you did make a comeback in 1991 and you had one last vestige of integrity before you slipped into the Great American Songbook.
and he lost that integrity that he got back with the MTV, with that 1991 album. And actually, Vagabond Heart actually came out in late 1990. That and the Unplugged, he flushed it down the toilet again. Why? His last number one song was a trio with him, Bryan Adams, and Sting doing that horrible song, All for Love, from the Three Musketeers.
Oh yeah. I forgot about that. Thank you for reminding me.
And what a piece of shit that song was. My God. Bryan Adams, Sting, and Rod Stewart. It's like three generations of crap.
There's a whole lot of blonde virility going on there. Yikes.
That's another one we could do an episode of. Sting, what the fuck happened?
Bryan Adams.
That's another one.
Bryan Adams, why the fuck happened? Yeah, it's just pretty bad. So there you go. So we've gone through the bad Rod, and you know, we had the great Rod, then we had the pretty bad Rod, then we had the god awful Rod, then we had the respectable Rod, and it ended with the shit sandwich Rod. And so here we are. I leave it to you, Arturo, to start this discussion. That said, with all of this mixed music and all this, he did get to $100 million. But otherwise, what do you say is Rod Stewart's legacy?
You got to go to Good Rod, the early years. Two things. Number one, like I mentioned earlier, his early years, his ability to take acoustic music, you know, folk, country, soul, whatever, anything on an acoustic platform and make it rock hard. Make it rock as hard as any electric band can. That's number one. Number two, his voice. That really soulful, gravelly, sandpaper voice of his. And his using that voice to interpret other people's songs and make them his own. Like I said, a lot of his covers in those early years were better than the originals. I'm an ass-slobbering Rolling Stones fan, and even I will admit his version his version. Oh my God, what's the name of the
Street Fighting
song?
Man?
Yes, you have to edit this. His version of Street Fighting Man is actually better than the Stones version. I'm sorry to say it, but it's true. I don't think any of his Dylan covers are better than the original Dylan versions, but they're very good. He has other covers throughout those early records of his that are outstanding covers. His ability to live inside the songs, reinterpret them, make them his own. That's the two-pronged legacy of Rod Stewart, making acoustic music rock as hard as any electric band could, and his amazing, unique ability at the time to use his, that wonderful voice of his to reinterpret songs and make them his own. That's what Rod Stewart's legacy should be.
Yep. And then the rest of that legacy is that he knew how to write a good hit song.
Yeah, he did.
He wasn't a very prolific songwriter, but he could write hits.
Right.
For better or worse. You know, like I said, you know, Tonight's the Night, even though I hate it, you got to give it up. You know, it was an enormous hit.
Yeah.
And it kind of cemented his legacy, or cemented what he did from there, that point on, you know,
right.
Stuff like Young Turks. You know, he really knew how to fashion it. He could find his way to the top of the songs, and to the top of the pop charts. And the fact that he was able to stay relevant in the mainstream relevant for 20 something years really kind of speaks to that ear for hits.
Right.
And he's, I guess his other legacy is just as a showman. I mean, there's a reason that he can do Vegas residencies and he can do these great American songbook records that he did all through the 2000s, and, you know, that he can do swing covers and all of that because the old ladies love him. You know, he charms the old ladies. You know, they've been with him since the late 60s. And again, his core fan base has aged along with him, and he's taking them along for a ride. You know, he's a showman. He's a real hound dog. You know? So
to his day, he's still out there. He's doing Christmas albums, doing swing old songs from the swing era now, and he's, you know, he's doing Rod Stewart. Rod Stewart.
but you also have to just articulate it this way: the guy had talent on loan from God. ... But he sold out.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think that's the ultimate legacy, that he unfortunately sold out, and he'll have to live with that for better or worse.
And I think he's perfectly fine living with that.
Yeah, really. Well, he's got the $100 million to show for it,
and he's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So, you know, there you go.
And with that, folks, we've come to the end of our Rod Stewart discussion. Arturo has finally come to the end of his lists of studio albums greatness by year. He posted 2019 last week, and he just posted a review of Pearl Jam's new album on our Curmudgeonly Community Facebook page. So go check that, folks, out. Go check that out. Certainly now, folks. Good times up there. Join the community. We'll let you in. It's facebook.com/group/curmudgeonrock. Also, hit us up with your thoughts on Rod Stewart. Did we offend your soul deeply? Do you want to hunt us down and kill us because we bagged on Rod Stewart? Send us a note at curmudgeonrock@gmail.com. And as has become our recent tradition, look for a Spotify playlist. Look for the link to a Spotify playlist in the show notes to this episode, wherever you access this, whether it's Spotify or Stitcher or Amazon or wherever else you get your podcast. Look at our episode description. You'll find that link. Click it and enjoy lots of Rod goodness, and yes, lots of Rod badness.